Hello, guys and girls. The program you are about to hear will be both fun and educational, but it is not a substitute for medical advice. Although we are doctors, we are not your doctors. Hello, and welcome to Tradicine. As always, I'm your friendly neighborhood internal medicine doc, Dr. J.
Hey guys, Dr. Nandipuram here, or Dr. Santosh, however you want to put it, pediatric infectious disease doc and researcher today.
So formal.
Yeah. Are you going to leave
all right.
Don't leave that in.
Happy holidays, you guys. I hope you're all enjoying your break. I know I am, presumably, by the time this goes out. I'm sipping on some cocoa. Hugging my baby Yoda plush.
Yeah, I'm super excited for those. Those are going to fly off the shelves. It's so cute.
Now, in a running gag, have you seen Frozen 2 yet?
There's going to be episodes and episodes of this. Okay, this weekend, I'm going to take my girls and I'm going to take Sanvi and we're going to go see Frozen 2.
Okay, because today, our stocking stuffer is kind of tied into it. Not really. I lie. But
you can segue it in if you want to. Many Disney classics were written by Hans Christian Andersen, especially those featuring very pale people who would mutilate themselves for love.
And today we're going to talk about Hans Christian Graham.
Yeah, small departure.
Because today's stocking stuffer, you lucky listeners, is going to be about one of the oldest, most reliable tests within our careers, the Graham stain.
Love this thing. Absolutely love it. And I was telling Dr. Josh before we started recording in here, our microbiology lab still does a Graham stain. When we get a blood culture positive, that's one of the first pieces of information that we get. And it still, to this day, helps us kind of guide and narrow antibiotic therapy before we have any other knowledge on what this
we
bacteria
Graham stain
is growing
when you're
person.
Sleeping. We Graham stain if you're sick. We check at the color of cell walls to find out if our antibiotics will stick. Oh.
I like it.
So,
yeah.
Let's briefly go into a mini-sode about Hans Christian Graham. Not Andersen, who wrote The Ice Queen, which Frozen was based off, but I just really want Santosh to see that movie. Those of you who've seen it at home, are you also lost in the woods?
Because
I am.
It's a very cute song. I've been listening to the soundtrack because my girls are absolutely obsessed with the soundtrack. So I'm very happy to say I'm already familiar with all of the songs. But yes, I think it is very important for me to go see this movie. But in the meanwhile, let's talk about bacterial cell walls.
All right, so Hans Christian Graham originally studied botany at Copenhagen, and this introduced him to the basis of pharmacology. And we've already talked about how closely botany and pharmacology are linked with my Netflix series I'm pitching, Benjamin Duggar, Plant Physiologist.
Love that guy. Every time I read a little bit more about him, I was like, Indiana Jones, whatever. It should have been Benjamin Duggar, Plant Physiologist.
One day he'll be recognized. But yeah. Hans Christian Graham, once he graduated from medical school, he traveled through Europe and ended up settling in Berlin. And as an aside, he was actually originally studying human red blood cells and was among the first to recognize macrocytes, or abnormally large red blood cells, were characteristic of pernicious anemia.
B12 deficiency.
While he was in his lab examining different tissues, one of them was a lung tissue from a patient who had died of pneumonia, and during the course of studying these cells, he discovered that certain stains were preferentially taken up and retained by bacterial cells. So in the first step, he took a smear of fluid on a glass slide over a burner flame and poured a little bit of crystal violet solution over it. And I'm going to get real technical here, and I'm going to toss that potato back to Santosh. So after he rinsed it with water, he added what's called Lugol's solution, or a potassium triiodide. And this acted as a mordant, so it killed the cells fixed the dye in place. Then, like any good holiday party, he poured alcohol over it to wash away all the sorrows, and noted that the bacteria he had done all these treatments to retains the color of the species, or retains the color of the stain, which he called gram-positive, while other species became bleached or decolorized. So he was testing this method of staining on multiple cells, but he couldn't quite figure out why some of them would hold the stain and some wouldn't, until he realized that the ones holding the stain had specific shapes. And his initial work with this staining process was performed on the bunch of grapes Streptococcus pneumoniae and Klebsiella pneumoniae. So, Santosh, you are our pediatric infectious doc and researcher. Why don't you tell us what a gram stain looks like from a research standpoint?
Yeah, this is one of the first things you do when you get bacteria in a tissue. So bacteria grows in a blood culture. You take a little bit of the culture medium out. You put it on a slide. You gram stain it. You want to find out whether there's bacteria growing in a lymph node that you've removed or a bunch of pus. You gram stain it. Let's go back a little bit to what the bacterial cell wall looks like. So if you have a gram-positive organism, your streptococci, your staphylococci, you have kind of a thin cell wall, and that's about it.
You know, it's like dressing for winter in California. You throw on a light coat and you go about your business, whereas a thick cell wall is like dressing for winter in Chicago.
Yeah, so gram-positive bacteria, a single membrane, a monoderm, and then it's got peptidoglycan on the outside, which is a combo molecule of sugar and protein. And those gram-positive bacteria will take up the darker stains and not destain very much, and you'll get nice purple coloring on it. And then the gram-negative bacteria, you've got a thin layer of peptidoglycan, but you've got giant membranes. So it's got a double layer. It's got a cell membrane and then a peptidoglycan and then another cell membrane. And we do have many other types of bacteria which are gram variable and they're indeterminate and they're not identifiable by this method. But the majority of pathogen-causing bacteria that you're going to see, whether it's a urinary tract infection or pneumonia or sepsis, you'll be able to use this gram stain in order to find it. So the gram-positive organisms will take up the dark stain, the crystal violet, and then the iodine, and then it'll hold on to it. And when you look at it under the microscope after the destain, it'll stay purple. The gram-negative organisms, the decolorizer will actually wash away a lot of the color, and you'll end up with this nice, beautiful pink. And what Hans Christian Gram was looking at that really intrigued him when he looked under the microscope was that Klebsiella, in addition to being gram-negative, in addition to being pink, it was also a bacillus. So it was long and rod-shaped, whereas the gram-positive organisms, by and large, that he was seeing were circles or spheres, which we call cocci, or C-O-C-C-I. And those were, if they were staphylococci, they were bunches of grapes. And if they were streptococci, they were chains, looking almost like a pearl necklace. So at first, these were very tightly associated. Oh, gram-positive organisms are cocci, and gram-negative organisms are bacilli. We soon found out that you can have gram-positive bacilli as well, and there's a few gram-negative cocci out there. But this observation was really, really amazing. And to this day, it is a foundation on which we can say, okay, our patient is infected with XYZ, and I need to give this antibiotic in order to treat them. And so, yeah, I can say, you know, oh, it's staph, you know, it's gram-positive cocci in clusters. I may have to use vancomycin or another drug which targets gram-positives. I see gram-negative rods growing everywhere. Oh my gosh, I have to worry about E. coli or Pseudomonas, and I have to use a completely different set of antibiotics in order to treat for those. And yeah, in the matter, Josh, of minutes after getting a positive culture, I can tell with this Gram stain how I need to change my antibiotics to better treat my patient until I get more information.
And not only is it one of the most rapid and quick guides to selecting an antibiotic, it also gives you a quick idea based on body systems, because Gram-positive and Gram-negative organisms do tend to congregate amongst certain body systems. The bladder tends to have a lot of Gram-negative. The lungs tend to get a lot of Gram-positive with some mixed. So you can get a feel for where the infection's likely to be as well from a Gram stain. Now, Gram himself was a very modest man, and when he first discovered this method of staining to identify bacteria, he actually remarked, he's like, well, I went ahead and published the method, though I'm aware it's very defective and imperfect, but I hope that in other investigators it'll turn out to be useful. And he didn't use a counter stain. So his original one either showed, you know, Gram positive or nothing, a lack of staining. So the four basic steps include applying a primary stain, which is usually something called crystal violet, to a heat-fixed smear of a bacterial culture. Then you add a fixing agent like iodine. Then you wash the stain off using a rapid decolorization with alcohol. And finally, you counterstain. That was the last step that Gram never did. You counterstain with safranin or a basic fusion. How does this change it? Well, when you add the decolorizer like the alcohol, it interacts with the lipids, the fatty cells of the cell membrane. A Gram-negative cell gets all those lipids washed away. So the sugar layer can be stained with the counter stain. In contrast, a Gram-positive cell actually becomes dehydrated from being washed with alcohol, and it holds onto its stain that much tighter. Now, this decolorization step is the hardest part of the whole Gram stain, and it's critical and must be timed correctly, because if you leave that crystallizing agent, or if you leave the decolorizing agent on too long, you lose the stain regardless of the kind of cell. And too long is a matter of seconds. So this really is key. It's really dependent on perfect timing to conduct.
This is kind of why for a very, very long time, I mean, this started back in 1858, this stain was extremely technician dependent. You had to have the right decolorizer. Ethanol was useful, but you had to make sure that, you know, back in the days before industrial manufacturing, that your ethanol was pure and all that other stuff. And you had to pay attention to what you were doing. You had to put that de-stain on and get it off in a hurry. There are newer ways to do it now where you're actually supposed to trickle it down the side. But Josh, the cool thing that we have nowadays is we have automatic staining machines. You actually just put your slide in place and then you hit go. And as long as you have the solutions loaded into some cartridges, the machine actually runs it through all the steps in a very precise manner for you, so that there's no like person to person or slide to slide variation. It's super
cool.
Now,
I could complain about a robot stealing my job, but I don't really want that job. And as we talk about this, the introduction of Gram staining, at the time it was first discovered, super popular, was around the 1940s to 1960s. Originally, it was doctors performing the Gram stains, doctor scientists, because that's what we actually were back in the old days.
We'd see the patient, we'd get the history, we'd get the physical. If there was a procedure, you know, like drawing blood or any of this stuff, we wouldn't call and say nurse or anything like that. We would draw the blood and then you take the sample yourself down to a place. And this is actually why we wore lab coats, and also why lab coats are no longer relevant. But you would go down into the lab and you would process the sample and often read the results yourself. So you'd look at the slide and you'd make the diagnosis without the help of anybody else. So it was extremely slow because, you know, you could only do this for one patient at a time. You know, and you didn't have all the wonderful support staff that we have today. But it was also, you know, kind of a satisfying time because, you know, you were the one diagnosing the patient start to finish and then, you know, selecting a treatment. And then even when it came to administering the therapy, you'd be the one, you know, either doing the injection or hanging the saline.
Nowadays, we have interdisciplinary teams, which I much prefer. But as I said, in the 1940s to 1960s, the general feeling was that the Gram stain should be considered part of the physical exam of the patient with an acute infection and belongs in the repertoire of all physicians delivering primary care. However, as we began to see hospital systems take the place of local docs making house calls, the clinician began to rely on a central lab, a micro lab, for stain culture and antimicrobial testing results, which means that while interns in the clinics and at bedside originally got training in how to do a Gram stain from their house staff, without oversight from laboratory physicians and scientists, the skills in Gram stain deteriorated. And, you know, I used to have to do, during residency, I did learn how to do my own Gram stain, how to do my own urinalysis. I would go into the lab and actually do those to gain those skills. And the second I left residency, I have never once been back down to the lab. I just wait. Sometimes I'll call them. I'm like, hey, can you give me my culture results now? But the problem with that is you've divorced the diagnosis from the technique. So as laboratory testing expanded, you had government regulation to make sure you would get accurate results by trained technologists because clinician errors were increasing because they weren't, you know, laboratory scientists. And because of an increased frequency of Gram stain errors performed by clinicians, microscopes and lab reagents were actually removed from near patient locations.
And, you know, there's a little bit of toxicity that comes, you know, if you have standing bottles of ethanol. And, you know, this is just one procedure that you have. The other laboratory techniques would sometimes require more volatile chemicals and more harmful chemicals and stuff that could aerosolize. Early on, when the doctor was seeing, you know, one patient at a time, it wasn't as big of a deal. You could pay attention to the procedure and everything that you were doing. But now that we're in an era of volume, you know, we have to take care of a lot of patients at once. I really, really trust a good technician who has done a procedure like this one 1,000 times to execute this a lot more consistently than I can. And Josh, I'll go one step further. I trust them. I trust their eyes and their microscopy much better than my own. Even though I do use the microscope frequently, and you know I'm reading histological sections as part of my research. Those guys, because they're looking at Gram stains regularly and sections regularly, and because they have a very rigorous and standardized way to do it, I trust them a ton. This is still the realm of pathology. So there's anatomic pathology and there's clinical pathology. Sitting above all those wonderful technicians and everything else who do our micro work every day is always still an MD.
Over the years, it's evolved from a clinician performed bedside test to a remote test assigned in many cases to the least experienced lab worker with minimal training needed to pass basic requirements. And the Gram stain has gone from the best rapid test in microbio to a subjective, poorly controlled microbiology test, which, you know, even though differentiating bacteria to Gram positive or negative is still fundamental to most of the ways we identify and select antibiotics, the Gram staining method itself is prone to error and lacks standardization, which Gram warned of when his work was published in 1884. Remember, he even said, he's like, well, it's a little defective and imperfect, but I hope that it will turn out to be useful. Nowadays, we tend to use PCR stain or PCR and DNA amplification and other techniques. However, Gram staining has seen a surge of new popularity again in being used to help identify new antibiotics. And that's where you have these highly skilled clinicians and laboratory scientists reading them on the research front as we fight up the battle against antimicrobial resistance. So I don't really see the Gram stain used, like I'll have a patient come in and whereas in the beginning of my residency, it would just be standard to expect that if somebody had an infection, there'd be a Gram stain performed before they even hit the floor. Nowadays, the only thing I'll find out a Gram stain from is when the patient's already been hospitalized for several days and I get a blood culture back, and that's the first step while I wait for the other information. So it's still useful, but it's no longer absolutely 100% necessary, because by the time I get Gram stain information on the clinic side, I've already had the person on antibiotics for a couple days that I've picked based on what I think the infection is, and the culture comes back and confirms and gives me much more detail. So the Gram stain isn't really used, or it's not as useful in a clinical setting as more as it used to be. We have better tests these days. But historically, fascinating.
It does depend on the lab. I agree with you by and large in community-based hospitals. If you're in a clinic, especially if you're in a remote area and you're thin on really good technicians and lab scientists, then you're absolutely right. In an institution like the one that I work in, which is large and urban and run by an excellent microbiology PhD, we still do get a first pass on Gram stains. And in pediatrics, especially kids who are septic, that blood culture will actually come back positive in about 12 hours. And so when I have the technician and they say, okay, well, 12 hours, it comes back positive. Yes, the kid's already on antibiotics, but they can turn to me and they can say, oh, doc, you've got, gram-positive coccine clusters, or you've got gram-negative rods, then I can say, oh, all right, this came from a urinary tract infection, or this bacteria came from the skin, or they have a pneumonia. And I actually can start to tailor my antibiotics, right then and there. Josh, I got to give it to you. We have rapid testing. We have a beautiful machine called a MALDI-TOF, which actually tells me what bacteria I have by reading mass spectrometry, the proteins in the ribosomes, and telling you, what the bacteria is with insane accuracy. And then we have other rapid fluorescent type of things where you get a fluorescent marker which hybridizes with the right part of a stretch of DNA on the bacteria, and the little machine reads it and says, you've got E. coli. And at the same time, it tells me what the E. coli is vulnerable to. And that it's compressed down from 2-3 days down to like 8 hours. So that is a lot of information that Gram stain was not able to tell me in the past. If there's ever like an apocalypse type of situation, well, what techniques do we have? Well, we have this little Gram
town
stain.
To town.
And Gram stain you can do because you don't need to refrigerate anything. You don't need any special equipment. You just need a little tub.
Yep.
So that you can put your dyes in there. That's about it.
Well, we would show up in a town. Here's how this would play out. We'd show up in a town and we'd be like, we're two traveling doctors. And people would be thrilled.
Why?
And then
for being a
we
witch?
Would tell them, it turns out that you have tiny little bugs in your blood. And they'd be
I
like,
can tell you
no,
exactly
we don't. And then you'd
why.
Bust out your lab kit.
He's sick.
And
no. Oh, thank you, doctor.
See, they
he's a witch.
But the last moment or two on these Gram stains, again, the reason that I think it's phasing out is although it's quick and easy to interpret, it's great when speed is of the essence. Like if you have a spinal infection, you need to know it within minutes if there's something there.
Yeah.
However, there are some bugs where the usefulness diminishes because a few bacteria species will stain positive early in the growth and then become gram negative later. So depending on when in the infection you catch them, the stain can change. So it's a very, even when performed by a very talented interpreter, the test itself has varied utility depending on when you catch the infection.
Right. And the other issue that, we always have to be concerned about is
cocaine and heroin
resistance. When Gram stain first, Gram stain, that's not his name. When Gram first came out with his Gram stain, there were no antibiotics.
I've got a sore throat.
You didn't
Why
even
do you
have
do
penicillin
some cocaine about it?
It would definitely make your throat less sore for that short amount of time. I think the utility when you did not have any antimicrobial resistance, when you could say, oh, I've got a gram negative organism, you've got a gram positive, especially like what you were saying, Josh, is, oh, it's growing in the spinal fluid. It's growing in this liquid that I pulled out of the lung or in the abdomen, which in that time, you know, you actually had to deliver the antibiotic right to that
component. But who knows? Maybe one of our listeners out there will be the inventor of the next version of Gram Stain, and then I can talk about them in a delightfully immature manner in the next Stocking Stuffer or future episodes of Travel Medicine. So that's it for this Stocking Stuffer. I hope you're all stuffing yourselves silly and having delightful holidays. This show is produced by me with a lot of help from Dr. Santosh and friends. Our theme music is composed by Rachel Leisure. As always, we love to hear your comments, questions, and feedback. If you'd like to support us spiritually, emotionally, or financially, links to do that are in the show notes, along with anything we use to research, along with links to sources used to research this episode. And until next time, as always, happy travels.